This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're about to listen to a brand new series of Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley. New episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts, but if you're in the UK, you can listen to the latest episodes a week early, first on BBC Sounds.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel back more than 100 years to revisit the audacious crimes of swindlers, hustlers, and women on the make. Women who were trying to make it in a world made for men. What do their lives and their crimes tell us about women in the past? And how different is it for women today? Have you ever rented a really nice apartment and spotted a particularly attractive picture on the wall and thought, I wouldn't mind taking that away with me? Well, meet a couple who do just that, again and again.
You are charged with stealing an oil painting, a plated coffee pot, four pictures, a timepiece and other articles to the value of £20.
I found on them a great quantity of pawnbroker's duplicates relating to pictures and other property, which I have no doubt had been stolen from other lodgings.
The prisoners have been indicted on three charges, but at least a dozen charges could have been brought forward by the police.
Today I'm investigating an art thief, Amélie Découpère, who's living with her husband Paul in London in the late 1850s. As well as paintings, she's quite happy to pinch pretty much anything else from her lodgings that's valuable and isn't nailed down. And to add a bit of glamour to our story, as you might have already guessed from Amélie's name, she's French. What does her story tell us about the differences between women's lives in France and England in the mid-19th century? And how does a foreign lady swindler navigate the English justice system? To help me answer these questions, I'm delighted to be joined by our guest detective, the illustrator and graphic artist Malika Favre. Malika, welcome to Lady Swindlers.
Hi, lovely to be here.
Malika, you live in Barcelona now, but you did live for some time in England. I'm curious about why Amélie and her husband moved from France to London. But first, I want to know what drew you as a young French woman to London. Because honestly, most English people would say that France is the nicer place to live.
That's interesting. But actually, I was always fascinated by England. I don't know, it might have to do with, you know, Hugh Grant, you know, in the British movies. And
Hugh Grant!
Really, it did. Yes, it did. Four weddings and a funeral. Iconic. When I finished art school in Paris, I had the opportunity to go to a school just outside of London. And I thought, I'm going to go there for a year and come back. And I stayed 15.
Well, Hugh Grant is very good for international relations, obviously. What did you find most challenging about life in England when you first arrived?
The language was a bit challenging, but it was more understanding the culture. Because we are so close geographically, but I think we're very, very different culturally. You know, our conversations and communication, and French people were more direct.
Now, back to Victorian London. On the 10th of June, 1859, Amélie and her husband, Paul, move into furnished lodgings in the house of a Mr. Berry at 96 Great Russell Street, Bloomsbury. It's close to the British Museum. It's a respectable middle-class part of town. Paul claims to be a dealer in ribbons. And he carries round with him a case. He says it contains the samples of the ribbons that he needs to show to his clients. The only significant luggage the couple bring to the house is a big chest, and Paul says that he's got ribbons in that too. Amelie and Paul live at 96 Great Russell Street for just 6 days, until the 16th of June, when Mr. Berry notices they've gone missing. Also missing are his coffee pot, a clock, and several paintings, one of which has been cut from its frame. Poor Mr. Berry, he informs the police. And a Sergeant Lambert from Bow Street Police Station traces Amelie and her husband to their new lodgings in Portland Street, Soho. Ooh, looks like the game's up for Amelie and Paul. Malika Favre, Amelie is stealing nice things. Coffee pots, paintings, clocks. She's French, so I'm immediately assuming that she's stylish and that she's got good taste. Am I falling into a cliched assumption here? What do you think?
Well, actually, as you were describing it, I was like, she's my kind of girl. No, but it's true. I think maybe it is a cliche, but I think it is somewhat true. I love beautiful things. I've been to many lovely places around the world and seen things and been like, ooh, I would take this home. I don't.
Yeah.
But I can understand where she's coming from.
Okay, interesting. Back to Amelie Découpère. To find out more about her, I went with our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, to Bow Street Museum of Crime and Justice. It was formerly the police station and the magistrates' court where the Découpères faced their committal hearing.
Here we are in cell number one. I'm just shutting us in, Ross. Wow! I love locking Ross into prison cells. The cell is pretty much like the one Amelie would have been brought to. It's tall, it's echoing, it's very drab. The light is from a really high up window. You're not going to climb out of that one. And the walls are covered with ceramic tiles. And the bed, well, I call it a bed, is like a narrow wooden bench. And it's quite chilling to think of all the people over the years who would have sat on that bench and looked at these walls and thought, oh, what have I done? Ros, can you tell me how good the police were in the 1850s at catching criminals and bringing them here, like Sergeant Lambert did?
Well, I think they were probably as successful as they could be, given the lack of technology at their disposal. Local forces relied on knowledge of the local area, local information.
Sort of community policing.
Yeah, what I would call shoe leather policing.
Shoe leather policing, yeah. I like
out
it.
Out on the beat, yeah. Out talking to people and collecting evidence.
Amelie and Paul have moved to London from France. And could you quite freely cross borders in the 1850s?
Yeah, you could. Restrictions on immigration are a feature of the 20th century. And until 1900, really, people from other countries could just enter and live in Britain at will.
What do we actually know about Amelie and her husband, Paul?
Amelie was aged 28 mm-hmm. at the time of this case, and Paul was 32. When they were searching their new Soho lodgings that they had moved into, Sergeant Lambert finds a marriage certificate in a box belonging to Amelie. So it was a certificate of marriage for Antoine Thuillet and Louise Baudouin. The certificate had been signed by the mayor of the 4th arrondissement in Paris in June 1849, and on that certificate, the new wife is described as a lace maker. Now, we're pretty sure that this is Amelie and Paul's marriage certificate, and Découpère is an alias. Okay. The police also find letters and invoices addressed to Antoine Thuillet, a.k.a. Paul. It seems that he had a business as a hosier and shirt maker before becoming a postman in Paris.
I'm liking this, but we don't really seem to know all that much about the background of Amelie.
Not at this point, no.
Intriguing.
As Sergeant Lambert investigates, he discovers that this crime isn't a one-off. Mr. Berry of Great Russell Street is just the latest in a long line of landlords who've been relieved of portable goods by this couple. These various landlords identify their stuff from a wide range of items recovered from pawnbrokers, including four pictures and the coffee pot stolen from Mr. Berry. At their committal hearing on the 25th of July 1859, Sergeant Lambert gives evidence.
The prisoners have been in the habit of taking lodgings, robbing them, and absconding. The husband's sample box being the usual means of removing the property, and the large chest being left behind to allay suspicion for a time, but invariably turning out to contain nothing but rubbish.
Sadly, we don't hear Amelie's voice at all at any point in her journey through the justice system. If she did say anything, it isn't reported by the press, but we do hear from her husband.
I have not stolen this property. I purchased the pawnbroker's tickets found in my room from a woman whose name and address I do not know.
Malika, I'm not terribly convinced by his explanation there. What about you?
No, it sounds like he's lying, plain and simple. But I really admire them.
Okay, you like their nerve, do you?
I'm kind of thinking, how could they think they wouldn't get caught, you know? It's like, it doesn't look like they were very discreet. And so, yeah, they have some nerve.
Well, Malika, how do you think Amelie felt going into her trial? Because I'm pretty sure that her English wasn't as good as, say, yours is.
I think she must have felt very frustrated. And I can really feel for her, because I know what it feels like when you arrive in a country and you can't say exactly what you want. And I know I felt like this, like for at least the first 2 years in London, to the point where my colleagues thought I was extremely shy. And it's only when I, you know, really could fully express myself in English that I realized, oh no, she's an extrovert.
Yeah, okay. Frustration.
Frustration. I imagine it must be very scary.
Well, the magistrate commits Amelie and Paul for trial. He believes that the evidence against them is pretty compelling.
The prisoners have been indicted on three charges, but at least a dozen charges could have been brought forward by the police.
Their trial is just a few days later, on the 1st of August. Paul's described as smartly dressed, but the press don't bother to describe Amelie's appearance. During the trial, Jonathan Witcher, the celebrated Metropolitan Police Detective, makes a startling revelation.
In March last, a picture of the Holy Family, worth, it was said, £2,000, was stolen from the museum at Amsterdam. And information being transmitted to the London police, the picture was traced to Mr. Attenborough's in the Strand, where it had been left by the prisoners the day before, who asked £1,500 for it. On the following day, the prisoners were apprehended in Cockspur Street, but as there was no extradition treaty between this country and the Netherlands, they were discharged.
This is not looking good for Paul and Amelie, and it gets worse, because Inspector Witcher has another damning revelation up his sleeve.
Information has been received from the police authorities in Paris that the prisoners have been tried there in their absence for swindling and fraudulent bankruptcy, and condemned the man to 20 years and the woman to 10 years hard labour.
So now we know why Amelie and Paul are in London. They are on the run from both the Dutch police and the French police too. Amelie is an international lady swindler. And she must know enough about art to know the value of these paintings that she's stealing. I guess that being on the run explains why they're using this alias, Découpère, instead of the name on their marriage certificate. Malika, this name Découpère, that's D-E-C-U-Z-P-E-R-E, can it be translated? It's difficult for English people to pronounce.
I would say it's even difficult for French people to pronounce. It's not such a usual name.
Is it a made-up name then, basically?
I think it looks like a completely made-up name. I like that they were also creative with their name then.
Well, do you know, I'm quite drawn to their sense of style. He's smartly dressed, he knows about ribbons, she knows about lace, they've been in the fashion business. And I think maybe they're sort of wildly creative people who've got themselves into a lot of mess.
The world is on the brink. wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
Back to our story. I met up with Ros Crone on the Strand in central London to find out more about the pawnbroker who accepted that stolen Dutch picture from Amelie and her husband.
We found the pawnbroker's shop. It's now a little coffee shop. It's a busy commercial street still. What was it like, Ros, in 1858 when Amelie and Paul came here with their rolled up Dutch painting?
Well, Lucy, I've brought with me a photograph of the shop. And this is more or less how it would have looked in the 1850s.
Oh, it's pretty grand, actually. Look in the window. They've got other large works of art. And I can see silver items. It's almost like a museum.
Yes, that's right. And then above the shop door, you can see the name, George Attenborough. Now, In the post office directory from 1862, he is described as a dealer in works of art. So you can see he's quite a high-end pawnbroker. The Attenboroughs were a famous family of pawnbrokers and jewellers.
Were they quite respectable?
Oh, I would say that these pawnbrokers are very respectable, actually.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, what you've got to remember is that pawnbroking was endemic in 19th century London. It was part of the whole system of finance because second-hand goods carried such value. The working classes especially would pawn their goods, take a ticket, then buy them back as soon as they had cash in their pocket again. And of course, pawnbrokers were also used to get rid of stolen goods, to exchange them for cash. And this could put some pawnbrokers in a bit of a difficult position.
I bet.
They could be accused of being receivers
like
of stolen goods. Yeah, exactly. But they also played a role in identifying stolen goods and passing information on to the police, often as a way of protecting themselves. And we see that they play a significant role in this trial in giving evidence against Amelie and Paul. There's something else really interesting that comes up at trial. The marriage certificate found in Amelie's box.
Oh yes, the French one.
Yes, that's right. So it's produced and the judge says, and I quote, "I take this document as prima facie evidence that they are man and wife. I leave it to you, the jury, to say whether she acted under the control and coercion of her husband or had taken a principal and independent part in the robberies."
Oh.
And this goes back to coverture. It's the idea that a woman's legal existence is suspended on marriage. Now, in criminal law, this did not mean that husbands were automatically held responsible for the actions of their wives, but where they were acting together to commit a crime, the wife could evade responsibility if there was evidence of coercion, that her husband had forced her to do it.
Is this also the case in France? Is it the same?
It's similar. So this time in France, we have the Napoleonic Code or the Civil Code. And really for married women, their status was reduced to that of a minor in law. Basically, we'll say that they have a kind of civil incompetence or incapacity. So really, we see laws enforcing women's subservience on both sides of the channel.
Malika, I'm finding it interesting to compare how the rights of married women developed in England and in France. Here, the fight for women's legal independence from their husband continued well into the 20th century. For instance, married women in the UK couldn't open a bank account or get a mortgage or a credit card without a husband's signature until the 1970s. Were French women in a similar situation?
Very similar, actually. So I think in France, you know, we got the right to vote, I think it was 1944.
Now, that seems late to me, because in England, some women get it in 1918 and all women get it in 1928. What were you doing?
Yeah, I don't know. But it's true, it came really, really late. So I think it's, for me, it's a bit shocking, especially, you know, when you'll see the Marianne being a woman and being the symbol, you know, of the French Revolution, the Marianne leading the people. And so I think you can wrongly assume that women had a more important place in French society than it actually did. But no, we had coverture. Women had to be obedient to their husband. And I think it's interesting in this case, it's about finding, you know, was she obeying in that moment when she was stealing, or was she acting from her own accord?
It's interesting what you're saying there about the misogyny within the French Revolution. In what areas of life are women in France still fighting for equality with men today?
Well, I think it's in a way pretty similar to the UK, I think, in terms of where we are in terms of equality. But I think the biggest hurdle in my eyes today is getting women to upper management. Most of the women stay stuck in middle management. Mm. You still have very few women who are, you know, CEOs.
Let's go back to the 19th century, back to the trial. What's the court's verdict going to be? Well, the judge and jury decide that Amélie has not been coerced by her husband. She's not let off the hook. Both Paul and Amélie are found guilty. Paul is sentenced to 8 years of penal servitude. Amélie, to 6. Roz has joined us in the studio. Hello, Roz.
Hello, Lucy. And hello, Malika.
Now, Roz, tell us, we're curious. Do we learn any more about Amélie from her prison records?
We do, actually. I've brought with me a copy of her penal record. I'll just pass that over to show you.
Thank you.
Yep. Now, her records say, if you look down the page there, that she had no previous convictions, in Britain at least. Of course, doesn't include what they found out about in France. And also that she could read and write, which I think is quite impressive because I'm fairly sure that's read and write in English.
Do we get any photos of her at any point? Because I'd love to know if she's this glamorous French woman with super red lips that I've been imagining.
No, unfortunately not. We're just a little bit before the time when photographs of convicted criminals were routinely taken. But I do have a description, which I'll pass to you. Oh, there we go. A physical description. And it says there that she had a fair complexion, brown hair, blue eyes. She was only about 4'10".
That's quite short.
That's quite short, yeah. But she was also stout.
Stout? This is overturning all of my clichés about glamorous French ladies, isn't it? Can you imagine, Malika, how someone like Amélie might have coped in an English prison with all the culture barriers as well as the actual imprisonment?
Funnily enough, I see her, especially with the physical description now, I see her quite as like a very small, fiery French woman. So I don't know. I want to believe she was fine, you know, in that prison system.
Yeah. She's now been parted from Paul, with whom she's been through an awful lot. They sound like they're a bit of a team. What do we think? Are we being overly romantic in thinking that this is a love story?
I think it feels like it. I want to believe that she was the one spotting the objects and spotting the paintings and kind of deciding what to take. And, you know, that, yeah, they were kind of like a little naughty power couple going around different countries stealing beautiful things.
Well, what's the end of their story?
Now, I have with me an interesting letter that appears in Amélie's penal record. It's a request from the Home Secretary that 6 months' notice is needed before her sentence and also Paul's sentence comes to an end. And this is because it seems like the British authorities are keen to comply with the extradition request after Amélie and Paul have served their sentences in Britain. Now, Amélie is released on licence from prison on the 30th of January 1864 after she served 4.5 years of her sentence. And Paul is released a little later on the 26th of August 1865. What we do not know from the records is if they were sent back to France to serve their long sentences that had been handed down in their absence. They disappear from the records. And again, I think it's a case of...
Changed their name again, haven't they?
The use of aliases in the 19th century. It can be quite easy to disappear.
And what happened to that valuable picture that they pinched from Amsterdam?
We'd be very pleased to hear that the picture was extradited back to the Netherlands.
Oh, the picture gets extradited. The criminals don't, but the picture does.
They're very happy to have it back.
Ah. Well, what do you take away from this intriguing story?
I think two things, Lucy. Okay, the first would be this. As anyone who has a holiday let today, will tell you that small items go missing all the time. The corkscrew, pieces of cutlery, they're not reported as theft. They're just replaced. I think it was similar in the 19th century with short furnished lodgings. We have some lodgers, male and especially female, who pilfered things, especially because even these small household items carried quite a bit of value at that time. They could sell them to the pawnbrokers. Criminal justice historians suspect that much more of this low-level petty theft from private spaces by women was going on than was ever prosecuted in the courts and so ever came into the criminal record. The difference in this case, of course, is the scale of the theft. There was a method, there was the trunk and a scheme, a modus operandi. The second significant thing about this case for me is that reference to the legal doctrine of coverture. Our views of the past, of the 19th century, of women in the past, they're naturally predisposed to see her as a junior partner. Coverture could offer this protection to women in this situation. And this is a case where it was considered. It was put aside, though. And Amélie was found to be a willing partner and responsible for her part. And I think this was commonly the case. We should not overemphasize the potential advantage that women had with coverture. There's a decision that she is an independent actor, that she has criminal responsibility. But at the same time, we don't hear from Amélie at all, do we? And was this because she was choosing to remain silent? Or was silence enforced by the court, despite recognizing her criminal responsibility? Or was her voice filtered out in the newspaper reporting? And so we see the way in which women's subordination at this time, their inequality, really operated in different ways and sometimes quite unexpected ways.
Fascinating. Malika, what do you take from this story of our art thieves?
There is so much that we don't know. We don't know if they kind of got back together even after and continued their life together or had completely different lives apart from each other. Was it for the thrill? Was, you know, were they kleptomaniac in a way? I think part of it might have been for the thrill as well, but she paid the price for it.
Now, Malika, you've shown a certain sympathy for Amélie with her desire for art and beautiful things. Have you ever been tempted to pinch anything yourself?
Yes, of course. I think tempted I've been many times, but no, I wouldn't do it. I do like to bend the rules, but not stealing.
That's why you've been a great person to get an insight into Amélie from. Amélie de Couper is technically an international art thief, but she's not quite such a swashbuckling figure as that implies. She did steal one very valuable painting, but mostly it was clocks and coffee pots, and because of this, she's elusive. We've had to work hard to dig out her story. She clearly had nerve, and her life must have been full of danger, as three different countries got too hot to hold her. But she survived. I'd love to know what happened to Amélie. Was she extradited to France to serve her sentence there? Or did she disappear back into the streets of London with Paul? One thing I've learned from her story is that the French Revolution was only liberté, égalité and fraternité for half the population. And women in France today are still fighting for true equality with men. Well, a huge thank you to Malika Favre, Professor Rosalind Crone, and the Bow Street Museum of Crime and Justice. Next time, we're in London in the 1860s, where men are in danger of having their drinks spiked and their pockets emptied by a daring lady swindler. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Jonathan Keeble and Alex Phelps. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts. And the executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with Lady Swindlers weekly on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
from BBC Radio 4.
The Russians will be launching a satellite sometime in the next 3 weeks.
I'm Kim Cattrall, back with a new series of Central Intelligence.
This is a CIA covert op, top secret.
The drama podcast that tells the history of the CIA from the inside out. Starring Ed Harris, Johnny Flynn, and me, Kim Cattrall.
Miss Page, such a pleasure to meet a real American.
Listen to Central Intelligence Series 2 first on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long-simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.